without very much discussion of what angles are maximum and minimum. But when you bring the ends very close together, I have never seen anybody discuss that one. Maybe you have, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, not at all. This is K2KEY. The point is that I only stumbled on this by experiment. You remember the experiment I did originally with 40 meters. We had talked about vertical, the classic vertical with lots of radials like I have. And then I said we would try something different for 40 meters, and that was dropping a dipole vertically down from a 65-foot support point right straight down and see what happens at that point feeding it, you know, in other words, as a, just a pure vertical dipole. And from that, I said, you know, what happens, I thought, to, well, people swear, you know, there's a lot of hands that say that the sloper is the antenna of choice for amateur radio. And I said, well, what happens if you start doing something in between, between a vertical and a horizontal? I mean, is there a magic point? Is there some spot where you say, uh-huh, look what happens at this point? And this is how I stumbled on it. That is, now, what is actually happening? I guess I still think I'm getting somewhat of a vertical element there, because basically a good part of it is dropping. Not, you know, as it curves out, but a good part of it, I don't see. This is the point. Where do we say something is vertical and then we start to see it becomes a sloper? At what point? I mean, is it that only a vertical is a classic thing that if you have to plummet, you know, with a level vertical? Or where does it become the in other words, where is the departure point from a vertical to a slope that goes?
I think we're into an academic area here, Mel. Because no matter how careful you build a purely horizontal polarized dipole, a little bit of radiation, unless the balance is perfect, a little bit of radiation is going to take place from the vertical transmission line that feeds it. So even a pure horizontal dipole is not purely horizontal. It's a very small vertical component. The two mix together. And so when you view it broadside, you may think the antenna is horizontal. The real electronic radiation may be 10 degrees away from horizontal. By the same token, when you've got a purely vertical dipole, depending on how you feed it, if you feed it at the bottom, you can keep it purely vertical. You feed it in the center, you got a piece of coax cable coming off at right angles, and a little bit of radiation is always taking place from that. No matter what balance you use, it's never perfect. So even a pure vertical dipole has a little bit of horizontal component. And there's nothing bad about that. There's nothing sacred about horizontal. There's nothing sacred about vertical. For a bunch of reasons, a sloper, and you find slopers of around 28 degrees, being very effective. It's halfway between horizontal and vertical, I could say. And the most ideal polarization today is a function of what is the azimuth angle of the signal you, of the guy you want to talk to. Is he in California, or is he in London, or is he in Mobile, Alabama, or Florida, at Dazmuth? What's the state of the ionosphere today? Let me drop. Because depending on the state of the ionosphere and the angles involved, you're going to be getting a significant number of cycles of shift of polarization. It's called Faraday rotation. That ionosphere is a plasma. That plasma has a magnetic field from the Earth mixed into it. The mixture of a plasma plus magnetic field is a Faraday rotating medium. So that beautiful signal that you launch, whether it be purely horizontal, vertical, slant 45, whatever, it's going to twist a number of times as it goes to the ionosphere between here and your buddy in London. You may think you're launching slant 45 degrees to the right. He may get purely horizontal or purely vertical today, and tomorrow he'll get something different. A hell of a lot of the fading that you see on HF bands is not because the signal fades away. Some of the time the signal is skipping over you. The bounces are occurring before you and after you, so to speak. Some of the times, a significant number of the times, the polarization is cross-polarized, and you see it as a fade. your antenna might be horizontal, and by the time that that horizontal signal launch in London gets to you, it's vertical. You've seen lots of evidence of that, Mel, with your loop antenna. The nice thing about that loop antenna is you have complete freedom to swish your antenna in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. And when it comes to long-range signals, like, for instance, Europe, I'll bet you have seen a variation from day to day as to what polarization gives you the strongest signal. I wonder if you've experienced that, Mel. Day and night variation, day to day variation in polarization on a long range signal. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Well, most of the experiments as I was doing, you know, this past winter was on 75 meters with the receiving loop, and many times, every other day it seems like I was going crazy at times, because people that I talk to, usually my friends either in, you know, Massachusetts area or out Pennsylvania, down South Maryland, and all that group I get together, well, I still do get together with. Many times I was twisting the antennas differently. I thought, oh, I know this guy. I usually set my, you know, from past experience, how I set the antennas to keep him up, and now all of a sudden I'm changing. In fact, I used to know how they were coming in, what was going on. And because I'd say, uh-oh, your signal is arriving now. I have the antenna almost perfectly vertical. And then I noticed that in many cases, yes, the signal, when that antenna was standing vertical, that's when the signal was really the strongest. And as I started tilting it downward, for some reason, there was the point where it was just going, and there was nothing much I could do with it. But I was able to come because of the situation of, you know, reducing the noise level to a very low factor and the Q multiplier and everything, and the noise squashes it, I was able to copy signals that down to literally where, on a column receiver I'm using, it's all calibrated dB, so I was looking at signals of only a few dBs constantly, maybe 5-6 dBs. You know, I should say, Dick, it's still what is going on. Again, we get back to the question that I cannot answer. What is happening with 10 megahertz? Why is this band behaving like this the last few weeks? What is the magic of 30 meters right now? Over.
I'm going to make a guess here. 20 meters is closed because the ionosphere is not there. 14 megacycles is not cutting it. 40 meters is there, but you've got a whole lot of atmospheric noise. The ionosphere is giving you reflection on 40. But in the daytime, 80, I know, is giving you a lot of D-layer with absorption. I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess you're getting a little bit of D-layer absorption on 40 meters. So 40 meters is giving you atmospheric crashes, not as bad as 80, but they're there, and some D-layer absorption. 7 megacycles is doing that, 40 meters. Get up to 10 megacycles, you've still got some ionosphere, most of the D-layer absorption has gone away, and the static crashes are not too bad. And the band is fairly wide open. Not a whole lot of guys using it yet. So, I'm guessing you're on that magic fence frequency where you're not too high where you lose the ionosphere, you're not too low where you got D-layer absorption, you're not too low where you got a lot of static crashes. And maybe your particular 10-meter receiver, the static ratios are better on 10 megacycles, 30 meters, and maybe your particular receiver you're using on that frequency range has a pretty good noise blanker. What do you think of some of those combinations being in your favor, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Point is, you know what it is, that I go along with your argument, except the only problem is that there are times when without the static crashes, we're, you know, it's fairly quiet from, you know, storm-wise. Quiet now once in a while, not too often, you know, just during this time of the year, of course, because down south in Florida area and all is the lightning capital of the world, so you're never going to get, you know, completely quiet conditions somewhere right now. And Northern Hemisphere is a lightning storm, I'm sure, out there. And we're going to hear it, especially on 80 meters. But the point is, though, when it does quiet down, I listen on many times to 40, where 40 is, you know, reasonably quiet, but yet a moderate amount of signals, you know, skip a little bit, maybe if you're hearing European moderately. And 20 is, you would think, would have, if 30 is so hot, why is 20 showing something? You know what I mean? It's not that far away from 10 to 14 megahertz. But night before last, I listened to 20 meters, I scanned through 20, I didn't hear a thing at all. But just keep things going sometimes. I'll just call CQ on the CW, you know, portion of the band, and then down on the low end there, and thought maybe see if anyone possibly comes back. There's a lot of times they say if somebody doesn't call, we'll never know. And but go over the 30 meters and there was activity. Tremendous amount of activity, Dick, up and down the band. There was good signals. So it seems like it is a dividing, but a sharp dividing point, Dick, in that I was wondering, there's no way of course to be determined if I went a little bit below 10 megs or a little higher than 10 megs, because we have no amateur radio band, so I don't know if there is some better optimum or a better, you know, point would be over.
Is there a way you can find out what was the maximum usable frequency on the day that you experienced this? Also, even though there's no ham band, there's some foreign broadcasts at frequencies in between that you can listen to. That may give you a hint. Also, on 40 meters, here's something I don't know and you can tell me. Is there any D-layer absorption left on 40 meters at high noon? 80 meters at high noon, you have quite a bit of trouble talking with simple equipment one town away because of D-layer absorption. But is there a little bit of D-layer absorption left on 40 meters? But the possibility exists that the maximum usable frequency was 11.5 megs. That would make 14 megacycles dead and 10 megacycles beautiful. Is there a way you can find out what was the MUF at that time you were doing this, Meldred?
Well, they do provide, this is KCKY. If you really want to get into that, you know, I believe they do broadcast different propagation that is reported, I believe, by the Air Force runs a situation like that where, you know, you can pick it up and check it. But the commercial broadcast stations, they are strong all the time, you know. You know something? Maybe that propagation and everything like that, you know, we talk about amateur radio, we talk about, you know, the sunspot cycles and all. Yet you listen, you know, like 40 meters where the Europeans have their broadcast stations in the, you know, 40 meter band, up in the upper part of the 40 meter band, and under the worst circumstances, they're coming through quite well. So maybe the secret is power, and big antennas will fix up what Mother Nature throws at us, Dick. Amateur radio, we're at the mercy of this situation. But I have a feeling that if I, you hear those foreign broadcasts, those coming through, they vary between moderately strong. I never had a distribution where to bear them over.
You're getting a little bit of intermittency of your push-to-talk button. It's a little bit hard to judge a foreign broadcast station because I'll bet you lots of them are running 50,000 watts and huge antennas. However, that means they're always going to be there. But still, from day to day, you can take a specific S-meter reading of that foreign broadcast station, and I'll bet you you'll see a correlation. In the case of foreign broadcast, you don't want to just say they're there or not there. In the case of ham radio on 14 megacycles, you say they're there or not there. But these foreign broadcast stations run such a high power, you can talk about, are they strong or are they weak today? Because they're always going to be there. Because they're so darn potent. No matter what the state of the ionosphere and atmosphere and troposphere is, you radiate enough power with enough antenna gain. Not only will the signal get through, but you make enough power with enough antenna gain, you will generate an artificial ionosphere. That's what Project HARP is, an artificial ionosphere. So you use enough steam, you'll always get through. That signal will always find a way. That signal you transmit goes everywhere. So at times it becomes very weak in certain places, but it's still there. It may be 20 dB below the threshold of your receiver, but it is still there. And with the right kind of equipment, you can sense the presence of the signal. You may not be able to get the audio or the Morse code out of it. You may not be able to demodulate it with any reasonable data rate. But telling the presence of it there or not there, you can always do that. There's some fancy digital signal processing equipment. As long as the frequency is well enough known. So I think when it comes to foreign broadcasts, you've got to take specific S-meter readings from day to day. Look at the standard broadcast stations that are close to 14 megacycles and close to 7 megacycles and close to 10 megacycles. I think you're going to see a correlation. But have you ever experienced any D-layer absorption on 7 megacycles, or by the time you get there, is it essentially gone, even at high noon? Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KEY. Okay, the D-layer, all right, let's say some words about that, because otherwise I know people are going to question. The D-layer is actually, the absorption of the D-layer is actually considered between 1.8 and 4 megahertz. That is the classic description of the ARRL and a number of other different, scientific studies. That D-layer absorption. Now, D-layer, for those who are not familiar with what we're talking about, let me just say a couple of words about the D-layer. The atmosphere of the Earth from ground, say from ground level up to, I think 10 kilometers is troposphere. That's what we sometimes hear on VHF called tropoducting from storms or whatever. And then above that is what we call the stratosphere. That's, say, from, somewhere around 10 kilometers up to 50 kilometers up. And then we start what Vic was just talking about, the D layer. And so this is the way the atmosphere is. That's generally how we, I guess the maybe the D-layer varies from season to season and how high up it is, but I think it exists somewhere between above anything above around, I don't know, somewhere above 50 kilometers. And during the daytime, it makes possible mostly local contact on 160 and 80 meter band, but it's usually not a factor above 4 megahertz, according to the ARRL, Dick, over.
Okay, that's good to know. Now, one of the things that for people who are hearing ham radio information about the ionosphere for the first time, the D layer is that pretty wide layer, quite low down as far as ionosphere is concerned. Above that is an E layer, above that is the F1, and above that is the F2. What's unique about the D layer is it's down so low that although the ultraviolet radiation from the sun is hitting those molecules, breaking them apart, making them into nucleuses and electrons, making them into a plasma, a conducting sheet of material, that's what the ionosphere is made out of. The sun does this for you. Because the density of air molecules in the D layer is so low as far as ionosphere is concerned, that the mean free path is very small. It's a fancy way of saying the electron doesn't have to travel very far before he finds a proton to mate up with, and he's no longer a plasma. He's now just an air molecule. So as soon as the sun goes down, the D layer disappears immediately. The E layer is a little bit higher up. It takes a little longer. The air molecules are further apart. They're less dense, and it takes a lot longer for recombination to take place in the E layer. The F1 layer and the F2 layer, when they're there, the F2 layer, it takes so long for those electrons to recombine that you may have that F2 layer there all night long. It was created by high noon sunlight, and the sun has set, and there's no longer any sun creating that F layer, but the air density is so sparse, there's such big spaces between the air molecules, that those free electrons and free nucleuses, free protons, are floating around independently, and they never meet up with each other all night long. So when the sunspot cycle is in a good portion of its curve, it's 11-year cycle, that F layer is there all night long. I am guessing the E layer disappears some amount of hours after sunset. This I don't know. Maybe you can bring me up to speed on that one now. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. All right. Dick brought up a very good point. The F, after we see E layer, now let's leave the E layer for a second. The S layer that Dick was just talking about, the F1 layer, which is basically above the E layer, actually laid out E, E, F. So in other words, we start down at the bottom at sea level, whatever you want to call it, Earth level here at the troposphere. Then we go to where the airplanes and all usually are flying, planes that are way up there, even those trails up in the stratosphere. And then we get to the D layer. Now, above that is the E layer. Now, the F1 layer is considered a concentration, a day concentration. And I think the reason for that is that at altitudes, certain altitudes, the low pressure situation creates what is known as, I believe it's referred to, and I may be wrong, but I'm just going to take this off the top of my head that I read it, called atomic oxygen and nitrogen predominate because of the very low pressure and because of the solar UV and X-ray radiation, they ionize these gases, basically. I think that is responsible for these layers. In other words, because the pressure up there is very low, that the UV and the X-rays coming from the sun create this ionization, and it's basically, I believe they refer to it as atomic oxygen and nitrogen. Is that correct? Is that what is up there, Dick, over?
I think so, but I'm not sure. But then you've got that F1 layer above the E layer, and I think at high noon you've got an F1 down low and an F2 up high. At nighttime, I believe the F1 layer down low is the one that disappears first because there's a little bit higher air pressure there. Recombination takes place. The way some books are written, it would lead you to believe that the F1 layer moves up to the F2 layer. I think the F1 layer simply disappears by recombination, and the F2 layer is the one that the molecules are so sparse, so far apart, that it lasts all night long when the sunspot cycle is proper. And the F2 layer is a nice reflective layer, nice high altitude, therefore you get the best DX out of that one, the longest range with the smallest number of hops. You might want to mention what is the altitude of the F2 layer. I don't know, but I'm going to be guessing it's something in the vicinity of 60 or 70 kilometers, very high up. And essentially never recombined in a 24-hour period. I think that's what happened. And what it's consisting of, there probably is a change in molecules as to whether or not the molecules are put together in pairs or in ozone. There is some ozone up there, and I know that ozone is giving us quite a bit of ultraviolet protection. And I know that the chlorofluorocarbon, the Freon 12 that we've outlawed quite a number of years ago, is because it was having an effect of depleting the ozone layer, and therefore, without that ozone layer, which is up very nice and high, a lot more ultraviolet radiation gets through, and we've given you a lot more skin cancer. So, to protect us from that, we get rid of the chlorofluorocarbon. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. You asked where the layers are actually. Let me think a minute. The F1, well, as I said, the stratus, let's go, troposphere is somewhere between 0 and, say, 10 kilometers. The stratosphere, if I remember correctly, let me remember. I've read all this stuff. No. Between 10 and 50 kilometers, that will give you the stratosphere. Then we get to the D layer, which is from 50 to about 60 kilometers. In other words, around 100 miles, I believe, up. That would be if I translate in miles. I'm trying to put kilometers and miles. You can go crazy with this stuff. Of course, we've gone kilometers and miles, you know, and we got to try to think metric, of course. So I'll try to say it both ways so I can think of how it's done. The E layer, I believe, is from is the center of what we call the E layer. It sits somewhere, buried somewhere around the 60 kilometers or the 100 miles up. That's the E layer. And as Vic said, I believe fairly close that the F1 layer, somewhere around 125 to about, oh, I don't know, somewhere 140 or something, is the, somewhere in that neighborhood, which would be about 200 miles up, would be the F1 layer. And if I remember correctly, the F2 layer sits somewhere around 190 to somewhere up there, kilometers, which would put it about 300 miles up. I believe that's the way it is. I believe we consider, however, the beginning of the D layer, in other words, from 50 to about 6, 50, 675 as the ionosphere. You always hear it referred to as the ionosphere. As far as amateur radio goes, I believe we consider anything from 50 to about 675 as the ionosphere. Am I correct, over?
I think all of your kilometers were right, but some of the miles may be wrong, Mel. You were taking each of the kilometers, like 60 kilometers, and saying that was 100 miles. You might have that backwards. Miles are bigger than kilometers, therefore there's less of them for the same altitude. 60 kilometers might be something like 40 miles. And so you said a number of those, and I think you said it the opposite way you wanted to. Whatever number of kilometers you're talking about, and most of the ionosphere numbers, they rate them in kilometers. In miles, it's going to be a smaller number of miles. Back to you, Mel.
I'm saying it backwards. This time of night, I start talking backwards pretty soon, too. 100 kilometers is around, if you would see, I'm thinking of a speedometer now. If you go 100 kilometers, I think you're going to, what, is that 60 miles an hour, Dick, over?
I think it's 62, but close enough. 100 kilometers, I think it's 62 miles an hour.
Okay, now I got it straight. Yes. All right, so there you are. So this is basically, so if we stick just to kilometers, we'll say that the ionosphere, as amateur radio operators, we're concerned from 50 to 650 kilometers. I believe that's what we can talk about. And the after that, from 650 or so up to, I don't know where, that they refer to that, I think, was that the magnetic scope or sphere. Oh, wait a minute. I can't think of one. Magnetic sphere, I believe. Is that part of, that's the upper atmosphere, Dick, of the Earth, over?
There, I'm not sure. By the way, I just did a conversion on my HP calculator. 100 kilometers is 62.14 miles. So, 0.62 to 1 is the conversion of miles and kilometers. And there's also a reverse one for kilometers into miles. I'll eventually find that one. I just gave you kilometers and miles. Miles into kilometers. I think it's 1.6 kilometers per mile, in that order. Magnetosphere, I right now don't know about that one. You and I are going to have to Google some of these words, Mel. But even though we may not know the exact altitudes, I think the philosophy of what goes on is the main thing these guys are looking for. So these are ionized levels of the ionosphere. It gives you various amounts of ionization depending on where the sun is. And it's the upper layers of the ionosphere that at nighttime do you the most amount of good. And I guess you can use both the F1 and the F2 layer on, say, the 20-meter band when the sunspot cycle is right at high noon. I believe that's true. Correct me on that one, Mel. K2KEY, KQLIW.
That's the basics. That's what makes the DX all day long when we get that situation when the sunspots are creating this effect of ionizing these gases. And that's where it mounts to. And we get the that F1, F2 layer and, once they are ionized. And I guess we could, well, maybe we should get into how the sunspots actually do it. That is a bit of the magic, Mother Nature's magic, of what takes place when the sunspot cycle starts to rise and how it affects these upper regions and what makes the DX possible. That basically is it actually makes echoes, makes it so that we have basically a method of an echo, like you have an echo situation. And that's it. So the depends on what we call the ion density and the vertical incidence or the critical frequency when this takes place. So that's a whole science in itself, Dick. I know you read over the propagation report, which I get, and it's a very in-depth science, so I think we'll just let it go at that point. Over.
I'm going to throw in a couple of words here. The sun does go through an 11-year cycle where during certain portions of that cycle, if you've got the right kind of a telescope, which really means you need a what's called a white light filter, you put in front of your binoculars or telescope. And if you study what that white light filter is, it looks silvery, most of them, and it is a filter which cuts down the amount of light by exactly 0.1 million to 1, 100,000 to 1. The amount of light that gets through the filter is 1/100,000th of the amount of light that would get through if the filter wasn't there. You put that in front of your binoculars or your telescope. I own one of these things, made by the Bader Company. It's one of the best brand names. Also, your Orion Company will sell you a less effective version of it. You put that on your telescope, you aim the telescope directly at the sun, and you'll see these black spots on the sun at the peak of the sunspot cycle. Each one of those black spots is where the sun is almost 2,000 degrees cooler. The surface of the sun is something like 5,500 degrees, 6,000 degrees, and these black spots are where it is 1,500 or so degrees cooler, and they look black by comparison. Those are magnetic storms on the sun. Those areas are acting like a fire hose, squirting out tons of material. There's an extremely strong magnetic field there. All kinds of violent eruptions are taking place there. And when that sunspot cycle is aimed basically towards the Earth, tremendous amounts of material get squirted out of that area, almost like a fire hose. And when those particles at close to a million miles an hour, called solar wind, when it hits our upper ionosphere, it does all kinds of things. It creates a lot of these, what's the word for it now, ionospheric ionization. It creates this plasma that we call the ionosphere. So when the sunspot cycle is giving you a lot of spots, you get a lot of action out of the ionosphere. 5 or so years later, at the bottom of the sunspot, 11-year cycle, when the sun is very quiet, we're going through one of those periods right now, let me drop. To use your solar filter on a good microscope, and not a telescope. By the way, never aim a set of binoculars or a telescope directly at the sun with your eye anywhere near the darn thing. Don't do that. Galileo did that and created some eye damage. Don't do it. Anyhow, and make sure, however you connect that filter, that it can't fall off while you're looking. That could create, in a fraction of a second, it can wipe out your eye. You'll really be unhappy. But right now, if you look at the sun, you'll see that it's extremely calm. Or you go to spaceweather.com, and it'll show you a picture of what the sun looks like today. And you'll see one tiny, tiny little black spot on the sun today. I think it's spot number 999. Now, they order them in We give them a number, and the number keeps increasing. So there's very few spots on the sun. There's very little material being boiled off. Therefore, the ionosphere is getting the minimum amount of excitation right now. And so, therefore, a lot of DX contacts are a lot more difficult to happen now than they will be a few years from now. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. All right, just one more thing to mention, because I know there's one thing that really was very popular in, I don't know, a few years ago about a whole hullabaloo of what's happening, if you remember, to the Van Allen radiation belt, the belt called the Van Allen belt. And that is, how do you explain, I guess, that part of the solar wind traps these protons and electrons, and it gets ionized and becomes this thing called the Van Allen belt, Dick. Is that the way it's referred to? Because I know I'm going to get questions of that. What is the Van Allen belt over?
Okay, one of the very first satellites the United States launched, I think it was called Explorer, but I'm not sure, way back in the late 50s, early 60s, Dr. Van Allen put a ionization probe into that satellite, and as it went to various altitudes, it measured the amount of ionization, and he confirmed what he had predicted would be there, and it got given name after him, the Van Allen belt. You've got a magnetic field where the lines of force, you could say, start at the North Pole, at the North Magnetic Pole, loop out above the equator, and go back into the South Magnetic Pole. Those magnetic lines of force are very good at trapping charged particles. An awful lot of the solar wind is charged particles that come and ordinarily would hit the Earth and they would be peeling away the atmosphere. That's what has happened to Mars. Mars has very little atmosphere because the solar wind for the last million years or so has been peeling it away, because there is no magnetic field on Mars per se. We've got a nice strong magnetic field. These particles that would ordinarily hit the atmosphere hit the magnetic field first. It is a kind of a shield. They get trapped in that shield, and they cycle back and forth between the North Pole and the South Pole. That's what the Van Allen belt is. A whole lot of these charged particles moving real fast back and forth between the North Pole and the South Pole, and they travel above the equator at some altitude like, I think it's something in the vicinity of 600 miles, but it's nice and high. When you fly the astronauts in the International Space Station or in the Space Shuttle or in the Soyuz, let me drop it. You're flying them in between two bad zones. You want to be more than, let's say, 150 nautical miles up, so you're not touching the top of the atmosphere. You want to be as far below 600 miles up, so you're not touching the top of the bottom of the Van Allen belt. You fly your astronauts through the Van Allen belt, and they're being cooked as if you put them in a particle accelerator. It's the equivalent of nuclear radiation. Those particles are moving real fast, they're heavy, and they do bad damage to biological materials. So you don't want to fly your astronauts at 600 miles altitude. You want to keep them as low as possible away from that Van Allen belt. That Van Allen belt, the tips of it at the North Pole, when they strike the atmosphere, we call it the aurora borealis. So if those same particles that are in the Van Allen belt trapped by our magnetic field, and I think it is essentially the same particles creating the aurora when they do come down in the vicinity of the North Magnetic Pole. But that solar wind, those particles hitting the upper ionosphere, are part, and also the magnetic, if the X-ray radiation from the sun also increases tremendously, X-ray, gamma ray, all of those rays out of the sun increase during the peak of the sunspot cycle, and I think it's the X-rays that are really making the most of the ionosphere. I don't think it's the actual solar wind that's doing it. The solar wind, though, I do believe, is the primary causative agent for the Van Allen belt particles, and they're trapped in that magnetic field. That's my understanding. I could have some errors in this. You better do some checking on it. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Essentially, you're correct. This is K2KEY. As Dick said, the cycle usually reaches just the maximum of every 10 and a half, 10 and three-quarter years, but very, very basically. They solar cycles have varied from 7 to 17 years since they've been keeping the records, which go back, way back. You know, they've been keeping records now about the different solar events, believe it or not, hundreds of years. As far as the X-rays, long distance propagation. Basically, as Dick says, is the intensity of ionizing, I believe, the UV, the ultraviolet, and the X-ray radiation. And this is, of course, the sunspots throwing off all this material that does the job. And, of course, the more sunspots, the higher it goes. And that's why we've had the greatest cycles so far in our lifetime. If you've been a ham, I consider myself in the 50s, was, of course, cycle 19, which peaked somewhere in the 50s and went way over 200. So I don't know if we'll ever see that again in our lifetime, maybe some of the younger people. All right, I think we sort of covered that pretty good. Maybe Jim, one more in, get my dick over.
Yeah, why don't you try to squeeze in another one? If you think you're not tired, if you are, say so, and we'll quit now.
I've just been outside all day long. Yesterday, today, a neighbor of mine had a ground pool put in, and we've been doing all kinds of things around. So, got a lot of fresh air, a lot of sunshine, so pretty much cooked pretty well. Nothing like fresh air and sunshine to make you sleepy. All right, let's see. Let me look at one more or something quick here that we can discuss. The West Coasters have come up with a great antenna, supposedly, for 10 meters. There we go, 10 meters here. 10 meters is now becoming a local radio band in lieu of using here 2 meters and all. A lot of the guys are now going to 2-meter FM, 10-meter FM. So it's becoming a hangout. And the antenna that they supposedly are recommending, all right, and we would like to know if it's worth putting this together. I've heard of this thing. I mean, briefly heard of it. It's, I'll give you a sketch, basically. The antenna, remember, for 28 megahertz, 28.8, it's actually around 28.4, I think, is what they usually get on, those guys. It's 73 inches wide. It's in a rectangular form. It's 146 inches. In other words, 73 by 146 rectangle. And the one side of the 73 inch is fed with a piece of coax, with a piece of regular 50 ohm coax rolled up into three turns to around a 1 foot diameter, three turn loop. And that's their matching. And what they do is they suggest you use the piece of molding, crossed in the middle, and you've got yourself a so-called, kind of a quad antenna, Dick. But they claim that it gives you over a dipole, I think, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of dBs over a dipole. Maybe you'd like to comment. Maybe run across such an antenna, over.
It sounds like one of the kinds of loop antenna. And loop antennas are very appropriate when you're trying to build something that is a small fraction of a wavelength of physical size. In the case of the 10-meter band, 28-megacycle region, where a half-wave dipole is 16 feet long, it is so easy to make a half-wave dipole, and if I want more gain, I can build a number of half-wave dipoles, stack them vertically, stack them horizontally, put them on a movable boom, make a yagi out of them. The dipole-like structure, only being 16 feet long on the 10-meter band, 30-megacycle, 28-megacycle band, is so easy. I don't know if I go through all the rigmarole of building a loop on that band. I'm not convinced that a loop has that much more to offer. Now, there are people who really love a quad or tri-band cubical quad antenna, where they build a spider-like structure, and they build a small loop, a big loop, and a larger loop, all concentric within each other, and build both of these a a driven element and a reflector, and they make a two-element quad-type Yagi out of it. That's a very effective antenna, not very expensive materials. So I'm not a big loop enthusiast if I'm not operating on a frequency where I'm forced into a very small fraction of a wavelength of size. The sizes you gave me are numbers like 6 feet in one dimension and 14 feet in the other dimension. A real dipole would only be 16 feet long. It's a fairly simple structure to build. So I'm not convinced this antenna has that much magic to offer to make it worth all the effort. But that's just my first impression. I haven't really read the article, haven't seen the physical construction, haven't heard the reports of how well it works. But most loop antennas don't give you much more than dipole performance when they're working correctly. That's my opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. I'll say a few words. Whether or not, I'll just say what I've read. According to the antenna handbook, the ARRL antenna handbook, they claim that a loop antenna would go approximately around over, let's say, a V, a inverted V. They claim that a loop antenna, do you believe, has approximately a 1.5 dB gain at low angles over a inverted V? If in comparison of what they claim is like putting it around 30 feet up, that the loop will perform better at 30 feet than an inverted V and show a gain of approximately 1.5 dB. That this is the claim that that is in the antenna book, Dick. Is that debatable? Over.
The good news is that it is radiating a vertically polarized signal. And so to compare vertical polarization and horizontal polarization is a bit of an apple and orange trick. The loop does have a this loop now, I think, is less than a wavelength in horizontal vertical dimension, and I think it's got multiple turns to it. So it really is acting as a magnetic loop, not as an E-field generating device like a cubical quad. I hope I don't have that one wrong. If such, it could be vertically polarized, and vertical polarization has got a lot to offer. I'm going to give you that. So vertical polarization, not requiring a whole great big ground plane structure, and still radiating vertically. And if you got it on a rotatable system, that's kind of nice. I don't think it's going to radiate very well broadside, if I understand the way this thing is generated. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, it is a vertical, it's a type of a quad, vertically, a vertical quad. It's, as I say, 73 inches wide by 146 inches tall. And they usually suggest that you put it on, make a frame for it of some sort using, if you use bamboo, of course, or whatever. And you can rotate it. Now, they're claiming, according to, if you want to, use the antenna manual as any kind of criteria for this situation. I mean, I read it over, too. I saw that once, a reference to that. That a loop will provide you with around 1.5 dB over an inverted V. I don't know what to say. That's why I think it's more in your field, whether or not, and they use a very simple matching network, basically just break the 73 inches on one side of it and put in a piece of coax there, 50 ohm coax with a few turns, about, I think like three turns, and that's the matching, so-called matching system or balance. And they claim that, in fact, it was claimed that it will provide better than 2 dB at over a dipole. Now, I don't know. It possible. I'm envisioning, you know, that there is a possibility, Dick, over.
Let me ask you this question. I think I heard you say that it's got three turns of wire. Or is it just one turn and you're interrupting one of the vertical sides and feeding it there? Back to you, Mel.
Maybe I misled you. The loop itself is made out of one piece of wire. It's just one piece of wire that's held on a type of a spidey, I guess you could call it. And this piece of wire is 73 inches on the bottom, and 73 inches on the top, and 146 inches on each side. It's a rectangle, basically. One turn, just all the way around. And they interrupt one side on the bottom, I guess you call it the bottom, the 73-inch piece of wire at that point. They cut it, put an insulator in, take a piece of coax, wind three turns of coax at that point, and about around a foot in diameter or so, you know, three turns of coax. And that's the matching system, Dick. It's a very simple antenna, over.
Okay, now that I see it as one turn, and I see it a little bit less than a half wavelength vertically, and a lot less than a half wavelength horizontally, let me think now, one third of a half wavelength, that's what, one sixth of a wavelength horizontally. I presume now this thing radiates broadside, is that true, Mel, go ahead?
They consider bidirectional, and with a very broad azimuth, really. That's basically because that's what they're using it for. I assume because there's always, I don't know what this belief is, that on 10-meter FM, you're better off being vertically polarized, over.
Okay, but do they claim that the peak of radiation is perpendicular to the plane of the loop, as opposed to being parallel to the plane of the loop? Perpendicular to the plane of the loop is the bidirectional radiation, is that true?
Roger, yeah, basically that's it, because they do recommend, I think, that you have either an Armstrong method or a motor drive way of turning this thing, that it is bidirectional, Dick, so I assume that they also said it's very broad, so you don't have to really do a lot of tweaking of it, but basically they're going for the advantage of the gain on it, because what has happened is they come out with a lot of these very inexpensive single-band radios, a couple, I think Radio Shack and all, was marketing a 10-watt, 10-meter, only one band, so, you know, just a simple radio, very cheap FM radio for 10 meters, Dick, over.
Okay. And the more I'm hearing about this, the more I'm liking it. Rather inexpensive materials, wood and wire and coax, and you could, if you want to, make it physically stronger. The thing is going to be 14 feet high. To make 14-foot vertical object that is rotated and make it out of wood and insulated materials to make it strong enough is a fairly serious engineering endeavor. You could have 14 feet of aluminum mast sticking out of the top of your tower, coming out of the rotator, and you could mount this thing a couple of feet away from the mast with a PVC standoff. The presence of the mast would add a little bit of capacitance to the top and the bottom, and you could readjust the vertical height a little bit to bring it back into resonance. But if you mounted this with PVC pipe, standing it off from, with PVC materials, standing it off a foot or so, from maybe even a half a foot, from your vertical aluminum tubing mast, you could end up with a very strong rotatable antenna, and you probably have the freedom of mounting other antennas on that mast. My guess is the average guy, when he builds a vertically polarized antenna, he thinks any vertically polarized piece of metallic structure nearby is going to kill the radiation. As long as it's a non-resonant lens, it's not there. It is 98% transparent. So my guess is the article recommends wooden and similar materials, insulating materials, because of people built in fear of co-polarized metal in the vicinity of an antenna. I think this is a beautiful example where the metal would not hurt you at all if properly used, and it could give you a lot of extra mechanical strength. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
This is KQKEY. Well, a lot of them, how they're building these things is they use that 73-inch side, top and bottom. What they use is a big PVC pipe. In other words, PVC pipe 73 inches long, and a piece on the bottom, and then they have the wire, you know, go through it and hang down on each side 146 inches, so that it's actually then tied up at the top, you know, and to put a cord or something up at the top on either end of the both ends of the PVC pipe. And hanging it up, you almost like you've seen it, this is nothing new. And do the same thing on the bottom, just pull it downward so that you make yourself, in other words, the PVC pipes actually act as your spreader rather than make it spider which you said is sort of an engineering job. But by doing it that way, just using either piece of wood or PVC pipe, you know, as the spreader on top and bottom, and then dropping the wires down, and then supporting it up on the top, in the center by, a couple of cords or whatever. You can use even the Armstrong method of turning this stick. Very simple thing to put together. It, I would assume, could be a very effective antenna, over.
Now, do they hang this thing from a tree? I'd like to mount it to a vertical piece of mast and put it on top of the tower. Thank you, Mel.
See, why not? I guess a lot of people have the availability out there of tall trees, so it just be a matter of tying up the top there and tying the bottom down, and just pull the cords around or whatever you want to do, or however you want to move it around, and supposedly you got yourself an effective, extremely effective radiator. I mean, from what they explained, I don't know if I could say, but maybe it's true that you can get a couple of dB gains over a dipole with this type of configuration. I think it may be possible to squeeze a couple more dB stick over.
Yeah, that compared to hanging a pure vertical dipole is an interesting comparison. Now, I get the upper pipe and the lower pipe, PVC pipe, the spreader, and suspend it from the middle with a cord going up to a high support and some kind of a puller down at the bottom and maybe other ropes to rotate it. How do they dress the transmission line coming off the vertical side? How does the transmission line get to either the upper support or down to the ground, Mel? Go ahead.
Transmission line is in the middle of the 73 inches on the bottom. That piece over there, they put a piece of PVC pipe across another 73-inch, and just interrupt the wire there, just drill a couple holes in the PVC pipe, interrupt it at that point, and then feed it there with the piece of coax and a couple of turns. In other words, that PVC pipe becomes the insulator, too, at the bottom, and the coax hangs directly right from the bottom straight down, over.
Okay, what magazine or what internet article did this come from? I'd love to see this, if at all possible. Or was it just sent to you as an email diagram, printed as if it was radio teletype? Go ahead.
Nowhere it was showed up. It was in one of the stores, one of the magazines. I think it was Radio World or something. I saw a mention of it. It was designed by this. You know, it's one of the things, I think, what is it, Radio World something? There's a guy they call Sturba, a guy by the name of Sturba. I don't know, does he really exist, this guy Sturba? Supposedly, he writes his article, Carl or something, Sturba. And he comes up with all fantastic different antennas. I think this is one of his antennas there. It's antennas put under that name. Person.
What's the actual name of the antenna? I'm not sure if I do a Google search, I'll find it. What's the name of it, Mel? Here's your copy bill.
Hello, somebody says something. I don't know what the name of it is. I really don't. It's, I don't know if they call it a, has any name specifically, but I think it's one of, you know, this guy, Sturber. Have you heard the name Sturber? Is he a real person? Over.
He might be. There's something in the past called a Sturber curtain, and there is a guy on radio waves or something like that, a series of articles. I think we got just barely enough information. We may actually find the original website on this one. And the more I'm hearing about this, the more I like it. I like vertically polarized antennas. I think they haven't been given anywhere near enough chance. And this is a nice way of building a vertically polarized antenna. I can't quite picture how on one of the vertical sides you mount the coax, and somehow the coax comes out of the bottom without interfering with the rest of the antenna. I can't quite picture that. So if I find the article, maybe I'll get it. KQLIW.
The coax does not come out of the side. It comes out of a 73-inch rectangle, 73, 146 on the side. And take one of the 73. In other words, the hanging vertically now. The top, you got a top 73-inch piece of PVC. You got another 73-inch piece of PVC down on the bottom. And the sides are 146 inches of wire. The bottom piece of PVC is where you put the feed line. In other words, you interrupt one of the 73-inch, the bottom 73-inch piece of wire at the center there. You follow that over?
Now I do, and now I realize it's a horizontally polarized antenna. I'm a little disappointed. But it's not dead, but it's horizontally polarized. They're going to shut us down in about 45 seconds now. This was TechNet number 1,193 of the series that began in September of 1982. Be kind to each other. See you guys next week. You got it, Mel. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Oh, it hangs vertically, this thing. It hangs vertically from the top, from the 73-inch piece on the top there. They tie two cords, keep the cord there, and hang it vertically, Dick, over.
Yeah, but you're feeding it as a horizontally polarized antenna, even though its major dimension is vertical. From what I'm hearing, that is a horizontally polarized antenna, Mel. Go ahead. It's a skeleton slot horizontal dipole.
It's hanging vertically. That's the point. That's the funny part. All right, we'll pick this up next week. We have something to talk about. MP3s, everybody. Have a great week, and don't forget Field Day next week. We want to hear everybody's experience about Field Day. Take care. Thank you very much, and we'll do our best to try to keep this going. Always a lot of fun. This is KQKEY. Take care, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Yeah, Mel, if I started off with an ordinary cubicle quad, square cubicle quad, not a diamond, square cubicle quad, and feed it in the middle of the bottom horizontal bar, that's a pure horizontally polarized antenna. The fact that I've stretched it vertically, but still keep feeding it in that spot, doesn't change the fact that it's horizontally polarized. We're about to die.
Yes, 73, this you have the left word, 73.
That's very noisy signal, I'm not sure, but I think he's agreeing with us, Mel.
I guess we call it a vertically polarized horizontal loophole. I guess that's the best way, over.
It's a horizontally polarized vertical loophole. You said it the other way around.
Horizontally polarized vertical loophole. Okay, yeah, I guess so. Whatever, but sounds like it could be an interesting antenna thing. All right, we'll talk about this. I'm so tired, really. I'm not thinking straight already. 73 is all. Thank you.